Well, US judge, the Honourable Eugene Hyman, has spoken the world over on the subject of domestic violence in the criminal and family courts and is a pioneer in the field. He has a special interest in domestic violence as it affects children in the home and also in the family courts. For 21 years, he ran domestic violence law seminars at the Santa Clara University School of Law, and he's advised numerous bodies on the subject of intimate partner sexual abuse, the hidden dimension of domestic violence. And domestic violence is, of course, an issue close to New Zealanders. We have a shameful record of domestic violence and sexual abuse here. And there's a financial price tag to it as well. It costs the country up to $7 billion a year. And just yesterday in the New Zealand Herald, another story of a woman beaten within an inch of her life. Judge Hyman is here to give a series of lectures related to domestic violence prevention, and he is with me now. Judge Hyman, a pleasure to have you on the show.
Good morning, and thank you for inviting me.
Decades-long interest in the field. What got you interested in this issue?
I had a lot of friends that were survivors of domestic violence that I didn't realize initially were. And once I became a judge, they talked to me about their experiences and it became real. I mean, it was a lot different than reading about it. These were people that actually experienced it.
And of course, is it true you were a police officer as well?
I was. I worked my way through law school as a full-time police officer. And I went to law school part-time at Santa Clara University.
Mm. Domestic violence is a subject that tragically never seems to go away. New Zealand has the worst rate of family, or one of the worst rates of family and intimate partner violence in the world. On average, police attend a family violence incident every 5.5 minutes. That's 279 calls a day. Do you know a little about the New Zealand experience?
A little bit. I mean, there's a lot of similarities throughout the world. It's a significant problem everywhere. And part of the problem is that culturally we have a tendency to blame women for their own victimization, because the question that's asked is, why do you stay? And that question is the question that's asked all over the world.
What is the rate? I mean, what are the differences? I mean, some of the differences or the unique challenges of domestic violence in the U.S., California. You have guns.
Well, that's a huge problem. And you have actually locations in California, very small counties. Our government is broken up by counties where you might have, let's say, two or three judges in a county, and they create local ways of dealing with the problem that don't necessarily comport to law. For example, in some counties, to get around the gun preclusion, if you have a conviction, they might allow you to come back in a year if you've completed the intervention program, which lasts a year in California. And assuming that you have complied with all conditions of probation, they will allow you to withdraw your plea, and then the prosecutor will dismiss the complaint, and it's like it never happened, and therefore you're able to possess a gun again. And the reason why that happens in some of these smaller communities is because the judge faces an election every 6 years, the prosecutor faces an election every 4 years, the sheriff faces an election every 4 years, and the political reality is that sometimes people are concerned about facing these elections. And as a result, gun ownership is a big deal in the United States, especially in rural communities where there's a lot of hunting. And if you have a conviction for a domestic violence-related offense, you can't own any kind of a firearm, in which case you can't hunt. And that's a big deal in some of these communities.
And so these penalties, they just wouldn't work.
Well, they would work for the first year, providing that, you know, you're under observation for that first year. And assuming that you comply, in some of these communities, it would be dismissed. And then if you were to commit another act of domestic violence, that penalty wouldn't be there in terms of enhancing because of the second violation, because there would be no first violation. But these kinds of things are political realities. Now, it's not a reality for someone like myself that comes from a county that's almost 2 million people. Then, yes, I do face or did face an election every 6 years, but it's a different kind of a concern. I mean, we had domestic violence specialty courts, our conditions of probation were enforced strenuously. And so there's that kind of political reality. even in my own county, domestic violence might be treated differently in some of the other courts in the north part of the county or the south part of the county. Not hugely different, but still different, yeah, because they don't have specialty courts in the north part of my county or the south part of my county because they're smaller courts. So
how complex.
It is very complex, and that's the reality, and this is the reality no matter where you are in the world, is that there is a local component, and I can guarantee you without knowing, just based upon experience, how let's say hypothetically that I were to go fishing in a river in Auckland and I didn't have a fishing license, I might get a warning in the city of Auckland. If I'm in a rural area, I probably would be dealt with less leniency with respect to a fish and game violation. I'm more likely to get a citation. I'm more likely to get a serious fine. And again, it depends upon the area, and it depends upon the local culture and the normal way in which they conduct business. So there are laws, obviously, that are applicable throughout the country. But in terms of how they're enforced and how they're viewed, there's going to be local variances. And that's just a reality, no matter whether we're talking about domestic violence or petty theft or hunting or fishing or anything.
On domestic violence, I'm quoting one superintendent, Tushla Penny. She worked on the front line for many years and has seen wives beaten beyond recognition. And she says, quoting, "We have to peel it back and get to the why. And when we ask the why and we still get a why, then we have a real problem. If we don't get the why, we will never change the landscape." Judge Hyman, does anyone really know the why? Why does it happen?
Well, it happens, yeah. It happens because of a need to have power and control over another human being, and it's usually male, and it's usually a female victim. It's 85% are the statistics in the United States. That's the dynamic. Again, we continue to ask, why does she stay? And by asking that question, that says volumes in terms of what our problem is. If we really want to solve domestic violence wherever you are in the world, number one, you have to have the resources. So there has to be resources for women so they don't have to keep going back. There has to be places for them to live on a temporary basis until they can get on their feet. There has to be training. There has to be observation of defendants. Courts need to have resources too. In California, our court budget was cut significantly as the recession of 2008. The court budget in California has not been restored to 2007 rates, let alone increases because of inflation. So when you don't have the resources, that limits in terms of what you can do. And when you have a problem where we continue to blame women, that affects resources allocations as well. You know, everyone is well-intended. I'm not suggesting that people aren't. I'm suggesting the political realities of the pressure on the courts in terms of volumes of cases, the pressure on politicians of all parties, wherever you are in the world, in terms of demonstrating a reduction in crime, demonstrating a reduction in spending of money so that you're able to demonstrate that you're efficient in terms of the monies and you're responsible, because everyone wants to get reelected. That's just human nature.
You also said something interesting. You did say, going back to domestic violence, about control, and you say it isn't something, correct me if I'm wrong here, it isn't something that counseling or anger management can fix. Do you need an intervention program that talks about battering, power and control, all these things? Is that what you said?
Yes, all those things. And the other thing, unfortunately, is that at least in the United States, we haven't found a specific curriculum that is more likely to guarantee success, which is why I feel very strongly that we have to protect women, because the programs sincerely brought about statistically aren't effective. And therefore, if we protect women, we protect children. And if we protect women and children, then they're more likely to avoid serial domestic violence relationships. And further, the other thing that we need to do with respect to men is convince them that they need to continue to go to programs similar to like an addict goes to AA or NA for the rest of their life. So if you truly want to stop battering and equally important want to stop control, then you need to go to a program for the rest of your life weekly just to check in and make sure that you are not controlling it. People can probably get to the point where they stop the violence. It's more difficult to stop the control. And if you beat a person enough, you don't need to continue to beat them to get control. You just give them the look. You play with a button or whatever it is that you do that they know that a beating is coming, and you get control. So if you really want to change behavior, and the programs in our area invite people that have completed the programs to continue to come for free. They want them there because they're of assistance in terms of helping other men realize what they're doing.
About control,
realizing what they're doing because they're the experts, they're the batterers. And they have more of a say than the program facilitators. But a lot of these people want to believe that they're fixed somehow as a result of completing the program. And their partners want to believe that they're fixed. But my experience is that if you don't keep going to a program, ultimately you commit a new act. If it were substance abuse, we would call it relapse. But in domestic violence, we call it a new crime.
Gosh, so this is a years-long process.
It's
not just
the
process. Yeah.
It's a life process. If you truly want to change behavior, and we're talking about any kind of addiction, whether it be drugs, food, gaming. Look at people that are into computer games and become addicted to it. I mean, it is difficult to get out of that addiction as well.
Well, I'm with Judge Eugene Hyman, a U.S. judge, and this is what Women's Refuge Chief Executive Dr. Ang Jury said, that there are two strands to the biggest question around family violence, from a New Zealand perspective. The first is that domestic violence is caused by alcohol and drug abuse and poverty. We have issues with all of these things. But I believe the other school, which is that in countries that have very, very strong gender-organized societies, that helps to create the problem. So, for example, Eugene, if you look at countries like Sweden or Norway, countries that put a lot of effort into gender equality, their rates of domestic violence apparently are much lower. Do you agree with that?
I certainly agree that substance abuse is not what causes domestic violence. I'm inclined to agree with her second statement, and I'm glad you brought that up because one of the great misunderstandings is that if people are clean and sober, that they won't be batterers. No. If you're clean and sober, you'll be a clean and sober batterer. Now, do I think it's important to get clean and sober? Absolutely. I've presided over a drug treatment court in the United States besides a domestic violence court. Being clean and sober allows you the opportunity to maybe get the message of going to the intervention program. So you have to be clean and sober to hear that message. Obviously, if you're clean and sober, you might commit less domestic violence because you might have a little bit more control. But please, I would not want your listeners to be misled that if their partners become clean and sober, the violence will stop.
Right.
Hopefully, it'll be less. But no, it's not going to stop because the underlying problems are still there in terms of the entitlement, the feeling that I'm in control and I have the right to control you and I have the right to physically abuse you, not just physically abuse you, but physically abuse the children as one way to control you and the pets and everything else, and sexual assault and also children with respect to, you know, the research is in terms of the number of children in care as a result of domestic violence is huge. The number of children that are sexually assaulted as a form of domestic violence is huge. These are all real problems, and this is something that's recognized throughout the world. And again, it's a question of resources. And I'm not being critical of anyone because everyone has a limit, just like a family budget. You know, government has a budget and they need to decide how to use it. And these are questions that are debated. In the United States, a big debate's going on now with respect to the Victim Against Violence office, and there are proposals to close it as a way of saving money. Which I think would be a huge mistake. But, you know, the government wants to increase military spending by 15%, and they have to make a budget. And so that's how there's talk. This hasn't happened yet, but that's how the discussion is in terms of saving money, in terms of we want to spend it here.
Well, while we're on that subject, now that you brought it up, the new administration, how does – How will that affect these intervention programs and programs that help victims of domestic violence, Judge Hyman?
Well, it'll be top down. And if it's reduced or if it's closed, it certainly will negatively impact women, children. It'll negatively impact training. And, you know, training is expensive in terms of time off, in terms of sending people to programs, plus the cost of the programs. You know, those are real costs. I understand that. But again, I think it would be a huge mistake because I think these programs are important, but that'll be up to the federal government in terms of how they spend their money, and this will trickle down or not, depending upon ultimately what they do in terms of the states. This is going to affect states because if they cut back on the amount that they are able to give to the states, then the states are either going to supplement it, and I suspect that most won't, and that's going to increase violence.
I'm with U.S. Judge Eugene Hyman on a visit to New Zealand. It's that hidden dimension, as I referred to, that's so chilling, isn't it? I mean, aptly displayed by a recent piece I read, Eugene, a woman texting her partner saying the office colleagues are wondering how I got my bruise. And she says, she texted, "I should tell them the truth." And he replies, "You will not." It's like an iceberg, isn't it? Oh, that hidden dimension.
Absolutely. And she took a risk in terms of texting him that way because ultimately I suspect that when she got home there was violence.
A couple of years ago, you were in Australia and you urged the introduction of specialised courts and, quoting, shock incarceration to deal with domestic violence. Can you explain that a bit for us?
Sure. Shock incarceration, what that refers to is that when you have violations of probation or community release orders, that it's important. Look, you got to be careful in terms of why you incarcerate, how you incarcerate with respect to domestic violence or with respect to any crime. We incarcerate out of concerns for safety. I think we shouldn't incarcerate because of anger. But when a person violates a restraining order, protection order, when they physically show up and they're prohibited from doing so, there needs to be a consequence and it needs to be immediate. And that's sort of the shock and awe of incarceration, is that they need to understand that they can't control the system. They've been controlling their partner and they think that they're privileged and they can just go about doing whatever they want. And part of the process of changing this behavior is to let them know that court orders are serious, that they will be arrested by the police, they'll be prosecuted by the prosecutor, and they will be jailed by the courts if, in fact, they violated orders. But they do, or they are entitled to a hearing for the violation to be proven, but during the dependency of that, they should be detained because they're a danger.
It sounds like a very tough-on-crime message from a rather kind-hearted judge.
Well,
shock and awe incarceration.
Former Attorney General Rob Holles in Victoria calls it a flash incarceration rather than shock and awe. Actually, shock and awe was my definition. But the end result's the same. When you violate something, there needs to be a quick consequence because otherwise it's like, you know, disciplining children. If you discipline them days later, it's not going to work. And with respect to a batterer who feels entitled, they have to know that that if they violate the law, that there's going to be a swift consequence. That doesn't mean they don't get a due process right. But on the other hand, if there's probable cause to believe that they've committed a violation, then they need to be detained pending a hearing if that's what they want.
Does this go back to that concept of control, that it's about control?
Yes.
That you see yes. Batterers, people who commit domestic violence, it's they don't just control their partners, but they try and control the system.
Absolutely.
Is this about?
Absolutely. They feel that they're entitled to everything and that the court won't take them seriously. Mm-hmm. And maybe they've appeared in court and maybe a court didn't somewhere take them seriously. Or maybe it wasn't even criminal court. Maybe it was an ancillary court where they didn't feel that they were held accountable. And as a result, they need to be shocked into the reality that they just can't do whatever they want.
Could that apply to a place like New Zealand? Shock and awe incarceration?
It can apply anywhere, in my view. Mm. Now, obviously, you know, you've got laws and you've got culture and you've got other kinds of considerations. But I think the general principle that when there's a domestic violence related offense, whether it be a violation of community orders or whether it be a violation of statute, things need to move quickly. For the sake of the victim, survivor, and the children, if nothing else, and also the batterers need to understand that they can't get away with this.
Another interesting thing you mentioned now, this regarding childhood abuse, that the time to start educating children to prevent abuse is young, preschool. We wait longer, it's too late. The average molester is 14 and has learned abuse by suffering abuse. Locking up paedophiles does not prevent children from abusing children. So is an age-appropriate curriculum the way to go here? So, for example, early childhood learning includes the proper name of genitals, that privacy must be respected, there are no secrets between child and parents. I mean, it sounds like quite a controversial thing, such early education around this type of stuff.
Well, I think it is critical to start educating at first grade, kindergarten. It has to be an appropriate curriculum, obviously. Mm. And some parents are going to be upset about that because they just are going to feel that it, certainly in the States, that it's inappropriate. But I think that it's important that you start teaching what is a healthy relationship, number one. And number two, what a child can do in the event that they are a witness to something that's not right, so that they can report appropriately and be protected. And not just that they be protected, but that the parent who is not abusing also be protected. So I think it is critical to start teaching these concepts as early as possible within an appropriate curriculum. Mm.
Some of the stances you've taken in your career have been also controversial. And here's an interesting one. For example, Judge Hyman, stamping a past due date on older records, meaning, you know, your record, your criminal record will essentially expire after 8 years or so. Do you still go with that?
Well, okay, we're not talking about domestic violence.
No, but just another...
Although if you are... if you've changed and corrected your behavior, I think that you should not be judged based upon a record for the rest of your life. What you're referencing is a law review article that I wrote a couple of years ago about the effects of criminal records on people. And so you've done your time, you've done your community service, you paid your fine, whatever it is. And then this record is like the scarlet letter with the scarlet A on your forehead. Rather than for adulteress or adulterer, it is F for felon or M for misdemeanor. And this affects the ability for people to get housing. It affects the ability to get jobs. It affects promotion. It affects all walks of life. And the average prosecutor in the United States is of the view that you should have thought about that before you committed the crime. But as we know, people commit crimes for different reasons and because of certain circumstances. I'm not making an excuse. I think that people need to receive an appropriate consequence for what they do. But I don't think in the case of certainly property crimes that a person should pay for that consequence for the rest of their lives with a record that keeps back haunting them. Some communities in the United States have laws called ban the box, in which case that unless a company, government can demonstrate for security reasons that they need to know, let's say you were applying to be a guard or a police officer, that would be an exception, in which case they would be able to know about your record. But if you were applying for a job in a grocery store and you weren't handling money, then what's the reason why you need to know? Now, if you're a pedophile and you want a job at a school, different story.
Yes.
So the circumstances would kind of dictate whether or not a sector needs to know about a criminal record, and assuming the vast majority of them don't. So in the vast majority of the cases, that wouldn't be something that's disclosed. But one of the problems, at least in the States, and I don't know how they do it, they have arrest records on the internet, not even just convictions, just that you've been arrested, and you can get this information from certain data collectors. So you might not get a job. Maybe you weren't even convicted, you didn't get the employment. You know, something else that you raise in terms of what is the role of a judge, and I think this is worth a couple of minutes of clarification. You know, judges must be fair, neutral, and impartial, and must be perceived as being fair, neutral, and impartial. So I wrote that Law Review article after I was retired, in which case the canons of ethics no longer apply to me because I'm not a sitting judge. I'm not handling cases. Some of the stances that I took had to be carefully crafted so as not to violate a canon. But now that I'm retired, I consider myself to be an advocate. I'm not handling cases, and I'm able to speak out on subjects that I think are that are important. Hopefully, I'm responsible in terms of how I address issues, but I have that freedom now that I didn't have before.
The Honourable Judge Eugene Hyman on a visit from the US to New Zealand. Eugene, it's a pleasure to have you on Sunday morning.